It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here today on the big program. Lots to get to, lots to talk about. Steve Dennis over at Bloomberg, he's one of their Senate reporters. He tweeted out today that the U.S. COVID death count topped 1,000 today. And look, you know, I've said before, I have a PhD listener who sends me all of his models. He has been spot on. He predicted this. Going to get worse. And it's going to get worse because, well, we're just... Wow. Wow. I mean, I'm watching all of the news that's going on. And I have this moment where maybe there's too much news. Maybe there are too many news sources. Maybe there are too many places where people are claiming to get news, when really all we're getting is spin and propaganda and well, your ideology. It's almost to the point where, and again, I go back to the former guy's years, where we were talking about alternative facts and, you know, there used to be a time where you could have your own opinions, but facts mattered. When you're getting 100,000 new cases of COVID a day and you're getting 1,000 people dying now today, we're heading to a place where at the end of September, the model that my listener sends me saying 300,000 people getting sick every day. And look, you go, wow, the numbers are so low of people dying. Yeah, but when you're talking about 300,000 people each and every single day, eventually that number grows. And we end up having thousands of people dying every day for something that we could do something about. And I'm looking all around the country. The news is of coming out of classrooms is that, you know, basically classrooms are shutting themselves down because all the kids are being sent home. All because we've got Karen going to the school board meetings, throwing a fit. And what happened today? I turn on Twitter. All I see is this conservative media whining over white rage. And look, they need that. They need that shiny thing. They need you are getting sleepy. They need the thing to grab your attention and keep you mesmerized and keep you watching and clicking and buying all of their stuff and buying their ideology. They need that. They thrive on it. And like junkies, like addicts, we go to it. You know, I had a conversation today with someone who told me that they're not political, but they voted for Donald Trump twice. Basically walking me through how Joe Biden caused the fall of Afghanistan. We were winning Afghanistan. We were winning, according to this guy. We were winning in Afghanistan. Until Joe Biden came. Winning. Couldn't define what winning was, mind you. But believed internally, viscerally, believed that Donald Trump was keeping us safe there. But when you look at the deal that they made, wow. You know, it was kind of an all giveaway to the Taliban. It was kind of okay, here, you take whatever you want. We'll give you, we're going to give you your prisoners back. We're going to give you your 5,000 people back. We're going to do all this stuff and we're going to get out. You can take over. Go out. He actually didn't believe that was the deal. I pulled it up on the phone. I said, here it is right here. Still didn't believe it. Could not believe it was what right in front of his eyes. And then, interestingly enough, and this is the weird part, again, as I talked about yesterday, this love affair now with the Afghani people, he goes, well, what about all those poor people? And I go, look, it's a horrible tragedy. It was always a horrible tragedy. But where were you 20 years ago when I was saying, don't go there? Where were you when the left was saying, don't do it? We don't have a clear mission. Go kill Bin Laden. Get that done. Could have done that in Bora Bora right away. Could have happened. But as soon as we did that, so we went after Al-Qaeda and we're done. Gather the sheep, get the flock out. But oh, no, no. It was time to now then fleece the American taxpayer and then use our corporate-controlled media to keep telling this guy that we're winning. We need more. Uh-oh, they're surging. We need more. Up, they've taken this. We need more. Keep funneling money. Keep sending money. Keep sending money. Keep sending our young. Keep sending our soldiers. All the while, here we are, all the while, being told that we're not being patriotic if we don't stand for the national anthem. Not being patriotic if we don't clap for the people who served in the armed services. All of these things to keep us, well, between the lines. Don't question the military. Don't question what we're doing over there. And our elected leaders didn't either. You know, as I just said yesterday, the Senate, one of the Senate subcommittees on finance actually did 42 hearings on what they're spending during Vietnam. Over the 20 years that it's been, Afghanistan was going on here, they had five. The difference of 42, five. Because what happened in Afghanistan was exactly what was supposed to happen. And you look at the strategic report that they came out with, and you know, what did we learn? Well, we learned what we always knew. We knew war was a racket. We knew the billionaires were going to do well. We knew corporate America was going to be fat and happy with their snouts deep in the trough. We knew it. And our corporate-controlled media, brought to you by Lockheed Martin, brought to you by Bechtel, brought to you by Halliburton, brought to you by Kellogg, Brown & Root, brought to you by all of the defense contractors, because, of course, they're the ones who are funding this stuff, keeping us stupid, not asking questions, not asking, hey, why are we spending so much money turning big rocks into little ones? Hey, why are we building a road to people who have never seen a car? You know, why are we, you know, building, you know, schools and massive buildings in places where there's no infrastructure to get to? Why are we doing all this? Oh, we're building the nation so that they can have democracy. Democracy they don't want. Never have wanted. They've never had. They don't even understand the word. But yet we're going to impose it on them. And this is one of those moments where I look at our free press, which is not free. It's owned by corporate America. And for all the lies of it's a liberal media, it's a corporate media. We do what the corporations want because they're the ones footing the bill. You know, I had someone tell me today that the Vietnam War was ended because of investigative journalism, because reporters were telling the truth, because reporters were investigating where the money was going, who was lining their pockets, and all of the horrific outcomes of what happened. There were actually journalists doing that. And when Walter Cronkite said, this is almost unwinnable, the nation listened. Today, if Walter Cronkite were alive today and he were to say that, he'd have 100 Fox News people going, oh no, see, he's not American. He hates America. He hates the troops. He hates your children. He kicks puppies. And then that would somehow play as news. This war in Afghanistan, our media not just failed to inform us of what was going on, not just failed to hold elected leaders accountable, but they were complicit. Because they profit off it too. They profited off all the stories. They profited off of all of the money that they got from these big corporations to keep things, well, within bounds. They had journalists embedded. And we looked at war as a game. I remember the first Gulf War. And I remember CNN. I remember watching the war on TV. It was like a video game. I remember watching it on TV and the flashes of lights. Oh, look at that. Oh, it was like 4th of July. It was like fireworks almost. And the humanity completely wiped out of it. You know, when those bombs dropped on someone, someone's life was probably ended in that moment. But we didn't. No, no, it was sanitized. It was on TV. We watched it like a video game. And it was easy. We didn't have to do anything. We could get popcorn during the intermission. And it was over really quick. We got to say we're number one again. Pump up our chest. The media played into it hugely. War was in. And then they talked us into another one. And we wanted it. Look, we wanted it. We wanted that feeling from the first Gulf War. We wanted Storm and Norman. We wanted the parades. We wanted the world to be afraid. We wanted to go get revenge. And our media was quite happy to feed that want. Instead of doing what they should have been doing, going, whoa, hold on, slow down. There are consequences here. Hold on, slow down. What is the aim? What is the goal? What are we doing? What's the direction? They didn't do that. They cheerleaded because they had front row seats. They had access. And with that access, normally you would go, hey, that comes with responsibility, if you're that close to it, to telling the truth. To informing the public. Because without actual news, without actual reporting, investigative journalism, nonpartisan, non-ideological, we become what we are now. Two countries within one, with different ideological aims, goals, views, belief structures, and pitted against each other. And when that happens, and again, this comes down to the politics of where we are. There's no middle ground left. You know, I say I'm a liberal. I'm an old school liberal. And the great thing about being an old school liberal is I'm usually right. History eventually proves me right. The war in Afghanistan, I was in favor of going and getting bin Laden. Got to go get him. We need that. You need the national revenge. You got to get him. But invading and occupying, I was smart enough to remember what happened to the Soviets. I remember reading about what happened to the British. Thought it was a bad idea for us. Dick Cheney himself even knew that invading and occupying a country was a bad idea when he was Secretary of Defense. Didn't matter when he was Vice President, because then it was about the money. It was really about the money. And again, our media let us down. And in this moment, where our media could really be digging into this 20-year war, could really be digging into the who, the why, the how, and then help us be educated about the lessons, the real lessons, on how we avoid doing this to our young people in the future ever again, they choose not to. They choose to focus on the horse race. It's Trump's fault. It's Biden's fault. Whose fault? Biden's fault? Trump's fault. No. It's Biden's fault. It's Trump's fault. This is where we are. Simple binary choices. Simple flip of the coin choices. Simple polar opposite. Keep people pitted against one another so they don't ask the tough questions. And the tough questions come back to who profited off of this debacle. Who made the most money off of this? Where did those trillions of dollars go? And who authorized it and why? And why weren't we at the wheel? For most people, and I said this the other day, for most people, the war in Afghanistan and Iraq did not touch them in one way, shape, or form. Nothing. Because the majority of us don't have people in the military. We might know somebody, but it didn't touch us. We were asked to go shopping. We were asked to prop up the economy. We gave tax cuts to the rich. It was business as usual on the home front. There was no mobilization. There was no war footing. And why? Again, it comes back, for me anyway, back to how badly our media screwed this up. And it's because, and for me, it's this simple. It's because they are embedded. They are part of the system now. I think it was Art Buchwald who said, you know, if you beat them up enough, they make you part of the establishment. That's what happened with our investigative journalists during the Vietnam era. That beat them up enough to the point they go, no, we gotta bring you in, and we're gonna give you access. You'll get first dibs. You'll get to jump on the competition, and you'll get the prizes and the awards and all of that. It'll be great. It'll be grand. You'll still be able to do your little less important stuff. But the big stuff, like, you know, us stealing trillions of dollars from the coffers, look the other way. And they did. I mean, you go back through all of the contractor crimes of the last 20 years, there was a story here or there, occasionally. But nothing like the graft that was going on. Nothing like the amount of money that was being funneled in who knows what directions with nobody paying attention. And I blame everybody. See, this isn't for me. This is non-political. This isn't, oh, you know, Barack Obama did. No, this isn't, oh, but Joe Biden is completely harmless. Because I don't know that now was the right time to do this. I don't know that now was the right time to withdraw. And later on the program, we'll talk to a military expert, Larry Korb, and maybe get some thoughts on when we should have. But I look at this moment and go, it's all of them, every single one of them. And even going back before that, every one of them that fed the military-industrial complex, every one of them that pushed for more military spending to be unaccounted for. And us just to shovel truckloads of cash towards, they're keeping us safe. Got to fight them over there so we don't fight them here. Nobody's been held accountable for this. Or any of these things. And they never do get held accountable. This isn't new. You know, we act like, oh my gosh, this is something new. This isn't new. This is the history of civilization. This is what happens. War is about money and power on one side, and, well, dead working class people on the other. For me, it's that simple. I got a lot to get to today, a lot to talk about. Going to take a quick break right here. When we come back, we're going to talk with Bruno Amato. He's running for Congress in California against Kevin McCarthy. This should be interesting. Quick break, right back. Stick around.
There's nothing more American than workers standing up, and the union gives a voice to win.
On the Rick Smith Show.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1934. That was the day striking Teamsters in Minneapolis defied martial law. They stopped scab trucks, forcing the release of their strike leaders. Armed with bayonets and machine guns, the National Guard had patrolled the streets for nearly a week. They seized scores of strikers and union leaders and threw them into military stockades. Drivers were outraged. They defied Governor Olson and Major General Walsh, who, on behalf of the Citizens Alliance and trucking bosses, were determined to break the strike. Soon after strikers were imprisoned, drivers began chasing scab trucks across the city. Multiple reports poured in of picketers forcing trucks to stop. Some unloaded their cargo onto bridges. Others chased, captured, and damaged the scab trucks. Strikers ripped ignition wires out, forced scabs from the wheel, and then disappeared before police and the National Guard could arrive to retaliate. In just 3 hours, strikers had overturned nearly 70 trucks. Unable to stop the superior force of striking drivers, Bill Brown, Vincent, and Miles Dunn were ordered unconditionally released from the military stockades. Now, employers, the governor, and other strike-breaking agencies were eager to propose peace to federal mediators. But they proposed to scrap the terms of their earlier May agreement. In response, the leaders of Local 574 issued a general strike call.
call.
In it, they asked, quote, "Is there one man so blind as not to see that if 574 is allowed to go down to defeat under the brutal hammering of military despotism, the whole labor movement of the city will have been dealt a mortal blow? Union men, brothers, sisters, fellow workers, what are you going to do about it? We appeal to you for solidarity."
Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So it looks like we're not going to get Bruno on the line. And look, I was hoping to have a conversation with him because Kevin McCarthy just... honestly, truthfully, one of the guys that when you look at what happened on January 6th, somebody I want to see testify, but somebody I want to see out of Congress. And look, you know, as I was talking about our media, the sad reality is we're in this space and there's no one to help us because our political structure has even gone just completely haywire where facts don't even matter. And I pointed that Lauren Boebert. Who had the audacity. And this is one of those things, that, and I want my Republican friends to think about this for a second. She had the audacity to say that the Taliban is building back better. As you know, literally people are leaving, grabbing onto a plane and hoping to hold on. It's crazy to me. And it's just one of those things that at some point you have to go, enough already. The audacity. I'm sitting here and I'm trying to figure out what was banging through her head when she thought it was a good idea. When she thought it was a good idea to tweet out that the Taliban is building back better. I mean, I literally can't figure that out. I'm struggling with it on an enormous level. But my Republican friends, stop and think. 10 years ago, would that have been the line of the Republican Party? It is where we are right now. And it's dangerous. It's scary. And someone has to be held accountable. For me, it's pretty much that simple. And until we do something about it, like get rid of some of these bums, it's going to continue. That's why I've asked Bruno Amato to come talk with us. Bruno is running for Congress in California's 23rd congressional district against a guy who, you know, Nancy Pelosi called a moron, and they're selling moron shirts. I mean, if taking on that kind of a name doesn't make you go, what is wrong with these people? It just makes me shake my head. I'm here to share some thoughts on why he's running for Congress and why Kevin McCarthy. I've asked Bruno to be here. Bruno, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, Rick, how are you, man?
I am good. I appreciate you taking a little time for us. So why? Why are you jumping? Same question I ask anyone running for Congress. Why? Why are you doing this?
So I'll tell you something. I say this. I'm a veteran, and when I joined the service, I took an oath to defend this nation against all enemies, foreign and domestic. Kevin McCarthy takes that same oath every 2 years as a congressman, but he doesn't defend this nation. He defends terrorists who attacked us, and that's basically what got me to run. January 6th, man, that was the big, I had thoughts about running, but everything came to that day, my decision.
No, and look, and I've been saying for the longest time, we need working people to step forward and run for these positions, and we as working people need to vote for fellow working class folks to ask the tough questions, because look, we look at what's going on in Afghanistan, and you as a veteran, I want to get your thoughts on what's going on there, but, you know, for me, this isn't about Joe Biden. This isn't about even Donald Trump. This is about the entire system that for 20 years failed our soldiers and failed the taxpayers and failed this, not just this nation, but the globe with their lies and all the stuff that went on. But let me, I guess I've pontificated a bit much. What's your thought?
Well, first I just want to say, like, as far as like being a working from the working class, you know, I see that union label behind you, and I'm a member of two unions, the Iron Workers Union and the Screen Actors Guild for like the past 20 years, but I was a union iron worker for a decade. But yeah, as far as this whole Afghanistan thing, I mean, to me, it was, you know, from the get-go, it was, you know, I mean, I remember the Bush being on that aircraft carrier with the big mission accomplished sign. Remember that? That was 20 years ago. I mean, it's, and we're still messing around there. All these guys, you know, I feel horrible, you know, that lost their lives or who now like have no limbs and, you know, their lives and their families' lives are totally destroyed because of this unwinnable war. It was like Vietnam all over again. It's just, yeah, I mean, I don't know what to say. I don't put all the blame on Joe Biden because everybody's like focusing on these past couple days where, you know, yeah, sure, things could have been done a lot better. But, you know, this thing has been going on. I mean, how long are we going to stay there? So it's just a tough thing, man. Yeah. I don't want to be a Monday morning quarterback and say, hey, this should have been done and this, that. I mean,
no, I'm with you, but here's where my point is, and I say this all the time. We should have never gone there, and I said from the beginning, if we do go there, because I grew up I was born in the late '60s. I grew up in the '70s, watching men coming back from Vietnam being dumped into my housing project with broken minds, broken bodies, horrible drug and alcohol problems, and nobody helped them. And one of the things I said from the start is, if we're going to get into these wars, if we're going to do this stuff, we can never allow that to happen again. And what I want in Congress is I want somebody who's going to stand up for those people and say, you know what? We did this to these people. We need to help them every step of the way to get what we told them we were going to give them. And Kevin McCarthy, in my view, I may be wrong, but in my view, he ain't the guy to do it.
Well, I'll tell you something. You know, 10 years ago, Kevin McCarthy promised the veterans in this district that he was going to build a brand new VA clinic, not a hospital, a clinic, brand new clinic. This was 10 years ago. It's now 10 years later, still no new clinic. So this guy makes promises, you know, like he does every day on Twitter. I mean, this guy is, it's shameful that like a district like this where, you know, there's a lot of hardworking middle-class people here. This guy does nothing for this district. I mean, besides veterans who he basically just lied to for a decade, you know, he hasn't held a town hall in 12 years. He voted against every kind of, you know, bill that popped up, you know, from the American Rescue Plan, you name it, anything that would have brought jobs and money into this district, he voted against. And the only reason he voted against it is because the Democrats proposed these bills. That's it. So he'll do anything to just be the opposer, to defend terrorists, to ignore his members, who are all, half of them are QAnon believers and all this nonsense. It's crazy. I don't get it, man. I you know, I'm a little older than you. I turned 60 this year, and you know, a representative should represent the people in his district, and this guy does nothing. Nothing for his district. This district, I'll just tell you a couple quick stats. You know, he talks about all these other cities like Chicago, New York, like, you know, Bakersfield, his hometown, which is where I am right now. Bakersfield has averaged a murder a day for the past, I think it's the past 92 days. The highest homicide rate in California for three straight years. Unemployment rate 2 points higher than the rest of the state. Vaccination rates 38%. This guy's a joke. I mean, he doesn't, you would think a vaccination rate of 38%, seeing people in hospitals and dying, that you would make a PSA to say, hey, save your family, save your lives, go get vaccinated. Nothing. This guy doesn't. He's down at Mar-a-Lago getting his friggin' marching orders from that other piece of garbage. It's shameful, man.
And this is why, again, I keep coming back to, Our elite politicians have lost touch with the average everyday working people. And look, I'm not someone who believes in term limits. I think we, the voters, have the ultimate term limit. And when we need to throw the bums out, we do that. And we elect people who have our values. So, you know, when you're out talking to people, you know, because I'm sure the campaign is just beginning. So when you're out talking to people, do they get this? Are they seeing the kind of things that you're talking about?
Oh, yeah. Oh, no. People, I'm telling you, people around here, you know, it's a very red district. Don't get me wrong. You know, we're going through some redistricting right now. So everything points to it turning bluer. But the people I speak to, you know, they all wonder, like, what is this guy doing? You know, we had we almost lost our country, as you know, January 6th. I mean, if things would have went slightly different on that day, if those cops maybe would have retreated and who knows what would have happened. Maybe they would have killed, God forbid, Nancy Pelosi or a couple other Democratic senators or congresspeople. Do you think Kevin McCarthy would have got up and said, hey, this is wrong? No, Donald Trump would have been president right now. Yeah. And this guy would have said nothing about it, man. This guy he's bad. He's bad news. His whole party. It's bad news. They're chaos. They're radical. They're just, sometimes I am at a loss for words.
No, and I'm with you. I mean, because, you know, you're a couple years older than I am, but I could have never imagined what we saw on January 6th. I mean, in my wild, I knew things were going to be bad during the Trump years. And I said it on Inauguration Day 2017. This is going to be the worst administration in history, the most corrupt, the most graft, the most, you know, the most chaotic, all of those things. I never in a million years said that there was going to be a coup attempt and the president was going to be a part of it. And we now know that that is a big part of it. And not just the president, but people like McCarthy who were involved in this stuff.
Exactly. You know, he was on Fox News. I mean, after the election, which was probably the most fair election we've had, you know, in the longest time, he was on Fox News like nightly telling people, you know, your votes were stolen. Donald Trump is really the president. So you fill people's heads with these lies night after night. I mean, Fox News does it every single day and night, 24/7. But a guy like McCarthy, who's supposed to be like the, minority leader, you would think there'd be some type of leadership or some kind of patriotism to the truth, integrity, honor. This guy has none of it, man. None. Zero.
No, I'm with you. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show here with Bruno Amato. Bruno's running for Congress in California's 23rd congressional district against Kevin McCarthy. You want to check out his website, brunoforcongress.com. We'll get links out on social media. So the question I've got for you, Bruno, is because, look, I look at someone like McCarthy as someone one of the people who has to go. How do we help? How do people help Bruno Amato move forward and take on someone like McCarthy, who has access to unlimited resources, has the power of his position, and a really corporate Republican Party that really has their messaging and a messaging machine like Fox News and AON and Newsmax and all that? How do folks help you?
Well, you know, I hate to say it all comes down to money. I mean, money is a big part of it, of course. And this guy raises millions, and you know, he's in the back pocket of big oil, pharma, the NRA. So yeah, this guy, you know, I mean, I'm sure he could probably put a billboard on every corner if he ever wanted to. Not that he has to. I mean, because, you know, it's a red district. But I'll tell you this: like, we've put up billboards where we're spreading the word. I mean, to spread the word about, you know, that would help greatly. You know, people just saying, hey, there's this guy out in California that's running against McCarthy. You know, I'm trying to do my best to get the word out every day, whether it's on, you know, social media, Twitter, Facebook. You know, I got a great team behind me. We're raising money. You know, I've been endorsed by some great people.
And you've got some really great ads. I hope folks will take a look at the stuff that you've put out. I think it's really good. I sense that you're like me. It's a hard time asking for people to make donations. I hope folks will make a donation to Bruno at brunoforcongress.com, because it does come down to money. And the hardest part of running a campaign, it comes down to dollars and cents. And I understand that as much as anyone. Last line of questioning I've got for you, because one of the things that you got to have a platform. I mean, we've got to figure out how we make working class lives better, because we're in the position we are in now because of deindustrialization and union busting and all of the things that Reaganomics and neoliberalism brought us. For us, we got to go back on that stuff and rebuild which was once a very prosperous working class in this country. How do you do that?
Okay, well, like I was saying, you know, I've been a worker my entire life. You know, I joined the service at 17. I've been a union guy for decades. You know, I was a union iron worker. I've been a union working actor for the past 20 years. So my whole thing is get, you know, I told you about the crime rate here. You know, you stop crime and you get people working. Like, that's a big thing. So my main platform is jobs. And, you know, of course, if I were in Congress right now, and that bill would have been put in front of me about, you know, the American Rescue Plan. And I mean, of course, I would have voted yes on that. This guy votes no. So, I mean, yeah, it's going to be tough. Like, you know, there's a lot. It's an oil industry here, you know, but I think the future is green energy. So, you know, I know that this district could, you know, the future is green energy. And I know that we can make a lot more jobs for people that are in that industry and transfer them over, transition to green jobs. You know, there's so much solar, wind things already here. And it's the future. I mean, oil is not the future of this district. So, you know, of course, he's not going to say that, but
Investment is the future. I mean, and this is why I'm such a big proponent of even the bipartisan $1.2 trillion infrastructure plan, but more importantly, the $3.5 trillion infrastructure plan. We need those to reset the last 40 years of attacks on working people. And we need the jobs that come out of it, Bruno, because you're spot on. You want people to stop killing each other? Give them hope and opportunity and a family-sustaining job to where they can go to work, they can have dignity and respect, and they'll stop killing each other, it seems.
100%, man. You know, you could put a, you know, add 100,000 police officers on the street, but unless someone has something to live for, like a, you know, and a job is one of the main things I think that gives someone dignity. So you start giving people jobs and good paying jobs and union jobs, I'll tell you, you'll see a big difference in this district and all over the country.
Again, the website, brunoforcongress.com. We'll get links out on social media. If you don't follow Bruno, make sure you do. Follow him on Twitter at BrunoAmato_1. I'll make sure we get that out so folks can follow along. I give you credit for stepping up and throwing your hat in the ring. It's a tough row to hoe, but I hope you'll come back and share some more thoughts with us as you continue down this road. And any way we can help, let me know.
Thanks so much for having me, brother. I really appreciate it. And union strong.
Good stuff. Thank you, Bruno. Bruno Abbato, brunoforcongress.com. Quick break, right back. Stick around and listen to The Rick Smith Show.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1949. That was the day that is remembered as Kemi Bloody Thursday in Finland. Two strikers were killed. Kemi is a lumber town in northern Finland. The lumber workers in the area went out on strike when the government proposed slashing their wages by more than 30%. The strike was soon joined by sawmill and dock workers. The walkout caused a massive logjam on the Kemijoki River. On the fateful day, 3,000 strikers engaged in a peaceful march. They encountered armed police, and a confrontation ensued. Police had guns on their side. The workers only had sticks and stones. One striker was shot and killed. Another was hit by a truck. Finnish army troops were called into Kemi. 32 strike leaders were arrested. In response to the violence, sympathy strikes were called by other unions, including the Siemens Union. These strikes were seen by many as a fight between the Finnish elected government and communists in the nation's trade unions. Officials in the United States worried the strikes were an attempt by the communists to open the door to intervention in Finland by the Soviet Union. After World War II, Cold War politics shaped responses to labor struggles in many nations. A song, Fly Black-Winged Bird, remembers the fallen workers. The lyrics, translated into English, began, "Fly, black-winged bird, with blood on your feathers across the lands. From village to village, carry your message. Open up, autumn sky, for the sad news to spread. Shame on a country where an unarmed man gets shot. Shame on the one who calls the shots."
Labor History in 2, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So on Monday, the United Steelworkers kicked off their We Supply America bus tour. They kicked off in Burns Harbor, Indiana, went all the way across Ohio, into Pennsylvania, Virginia, North Carolina, all talking about, hey, we need to build things here. We need to manufacture stuff. If we're going to rebuild our country, if we're going to build back better, we got to do it with American products and American workers. And here to share some thoughts and highlight this We Supply America bus tour, I've asked Roxanne Brown to come talk with us. Roxanne's an international vice president there with the United Steelworkers. Roxanne, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks, Rick. It's great to be with you.
So why kick off in Burns Harbor, Indiana? I don't think most people can find Burns Harbor, Indiana. What's there?
Well, what's there is Local 6787, where we have steelworker members every single day working at Cleveland Cliffs, making the steel that goes into a lot of our infrastructure systems. Beyond our infrastructure systems, that steel also goes into some of our weapon systems as well. But this campaign is about how steelworker members supply America. And we thought the best place for us to kick that off would be at the House of Steel at 6787 Cleveland Cliffs in Indiana. And it was a great event.
No, I saw the video, and I saw Secretary Walsh, Department of Labor Secretary Walsh speak. I saw, you know, the Congressman Marvin speak. My good friend Scott Paul spoke there as well. It was a well-received event. Lots of people, good crowd of workers, and people looking proud of the products that they make. And I think we should be doing a lot more of this. I'm glad you guys are doing this, but this is something we should be doing all the time, highlighting the fact that our workers make some of the best products in the world.
Absolutely. And, you know, and that's, I've been saying that this campaign and what we called it, We Supply America, is a bit of a battle cry, to be honest. You know, I think oftentimes when people think about infrastructure, because that's really what we're talking about with this campaign, they think about the folks who build the bridges and the roads and such, which is just as important, but they forget about the supply chain and the people who are supplying the parts and the components that go into these systems, our infrastructure systems. And so this is really our battle cry, that steelworker members across the country, including in Burns Harbor, provide the products and the components, whether it's steel, cement, brick, rubber, glass, chemicals, because coatings is a thing. All of these parts supply all of these systems that are so critical that help to run a nation. We Supply America. It's our battle cry right now.
Absolutely. And not just, you know, supply the things we need, but maintain communities with good paying jobs that allow a community to thrive. And when the factory closes, we know what happens. You know, opioid addiction goes up, poverty goes up, all of the horrible things. So for me, the idea of reinvesting in manufacturing, reinvesting in our supply chain, which has been, you look at what's happened over this pandemic, it's been magnified how broken our supply chain is. This is the exact time we need to be talking about this.
Exactly. And to that point, you know, today was stop number four for us in Danville, Virginia, and we were at local 831L, which is a Goodyear local. And our folks at that facility make bus, truck, and aviation tires. So that's our transportation infrastructure. But to your point about how these jobs and these facilities sustain a community, Goodyear is the largest private employer in Danville, Virginia. If that facility were to be not there anymore, it would be devastated. The jobs that sustain not just the families, but help to lend to the tax base in that community, to help to make sure that there are schools and libraries and hospitals, it would be gone. And so, you know, we want to make sure that what we do with this campaign is to help push what's happening in Washington over the finish line. So that that type of investment that you just mentioned is happening and continues to happen in facilities like Goodyear and U.S. Steel and Cleveland Cliffs and Corning and other facilities where USW members work around this country every day.
No, I mean, you know, my entire life, you know, we've always kind of puffed up our chest a little bit and say, you know, we're the global leader in manufacturing. In fact, if you ever been to Trenton, New Jersey, there's mm-hmm. a bridge there in Trenton that says Trenton makes, the world takes. Sadly, that I can't say that definitively as we once could in the past, because we've allowed companies to move overseas or to China or wherever. And this infrastructure bill for me is an opportunity, I think, to kind of maybe reset some of that. The fact that Joe Biden has said we have to have very strong Buy American provisions and we're going to rebuild our country with American-made products that are going to create American jobs seems to me to be kind of a reset to move us back towards, well, you know, what my grandparents' generation built, the most prosperous working class in the history of civilization.
I totally agree. And just so you know, Rick, I'm a New Yorker. I'm from New York. So I know that bridge in Trenton well. And I know that slogan very well. And it really does capture a lot of what we've seen across our sectors in the steelworkers. You know, unfortunately, we've become intimately aware and well-versed in trade policy because we've had to, use our trade policies to help ensure that there's a level playing field for our workers and their industries over the years. And you're right that, you know, this $1.2 trillion infrastructure package for physical infrastructure is a huge, once in a generation, really, investment in infrastructure with $600 million of new spending. That's huge. That's something that we've been calling for a long time.
Decades.
Infrastructure. Decades.
Decades, Rex.
You know, decades.
I've been saying it for the last couple of days. It was 14 years ago that the I-35 bridge collapsed. And mm-hmm. it was a decade before that that we were talking about we need to invest in infrastructure. So while $1.2 trillion sounds like a lot of money, the fact that we've neglected our infrastructure this long means that it's really not, and we need considerably higher. In fact, you know this as well as anyone. The American Society of Civil Engineers puts that price tag somewhere around, if I'm not mistaken, $4.6 trillion. Not $1.2, exactly. But $4.6 trillion. And that's just to get to about a B, B minus, not even to that's the right. A grade.
That's right. No, that's exactly right. Infrastructure has been the meat that Congress has left on the table for decades, as you say. And so that's why we have this campaign, We Supply America, to really try to, again, push as much as possible and support this effort that is working its way through Congress, not just the $1.2 trillion package, but that $3.5 trillion package for the social and human infrastructure that is just behind it, because it's not just about making the things. It's about the people who support a nation. You know, you mentioned the pandemic. We're still in this 18-month period. We saw what happened when we have a social and human system that is not supported, that system cannot effectively support a nation. And so these two packages together, for us, critical to get over the finish line. Necessary for the American public, necessary for American workers, necessary for American industry, and necessary for American communities.
No, something we most certainly need. And over the next couple of days, you're going to be traveling around. And Friday, you're going to end up in Pittsburgh, Tomorrow, you're going to end up Thursday in North Carolina. If people want to follow along, see where you've been, what you're talking about, uswvoices.org is the website. uswvoices.org, the website. Now you're doing this to raise awareness, and that's great. We need that to happen. What are you hoping comes out of this? You know, we're going to have these great events, and I'm a big fan of events. I'm a big fan of bus tours and all of that stuff. But what are we hoping to gain on the other side come Monday when people go back to work and the bus has been parked? What are we hoping to grab?
I think a couple of things. You know, a big part of this campaign is education. Whenever you do a bus tour or anything like that, it's about education. And again, on the first piece, education is for policymakers so that they can make a very clear connection to steelworker jobs, I'll say USW jobs and infrastructure, because oftentimes when people think of our union, they really just think about steel because we are, that's our name. But
you represent nurses.
We represent everybody. Nurses. We represent school bus drivers. We represent folks at American Water. We represent folks at National Grid. So it's not just the components and the things that are going into these systems that I talked about, but it's the folks who are servicing these systems too that we represent. And so this is an education about the full scope of the steelworkers. I've been saying it's our commercial for our union about all of the work that steelworker members do every day. So the first piece is hoping that policymakers make the connection to how many jobs are connected to this bill so that they see that it has to get done. Secondly, we want our members to know when they hear infrastructure, when they hear policymakers talking about this bill, when they hear you, Rick, or others in the news talking about this bill, that they know that it's their jobs that are being discussed. And third, we want victory. You know, come fall, we want to be one of the ground troops that help to secure victory and make sure that we have both of these bills passed and ultimately signed by President Biden.
No, and we desperately need it. And not just from the political side. I mean, the political side, the Democrats do absolutely need this to pass if they're going to be competitive in 2022. But as a country, we desperately need this. You know, for years I've been saying, you know, someone should do an app for people's phone that every time they go over a structurally deficient bridge, it sends a notification saying, hey, call mom. You might not make it to the other side. But I made that joke 15 years ago. So we're in this moment where we desperately need it. So let me ask you, as someone who pays a lot of attention to this, what do you think the chances of both bills passing? Do you see maybe one or the other or both? How do you see the jockeying of getting this through happening?
You know, I will say a lot depends on what happens now that the Senate bill has gone over to the House. I think Speaker Pelosi has been pretty clear about the path forward that she wants for these bills, that she wants, she will not move one without the other. And again, it's because she recognizes how critically important each of these pieces are. We never thought about social infrastructure before COVID. Never thought about it because we never had to think about it. We only thought about the physical infrastructure, like you said, the bridges that are deficient, the dams, the locks, all of these things, the rivers that need to be all. We never thought about the social infrastructure. We can't not think about it now. Well, so I think because of that, it's clear that both of them have to move. And so I have a lot of faith in the speaker. She's tough.
Yeah, I hope both of them. I hope they do both move because we desperately need them. But I might push back a little bit on the fact that we never thought about social infrastructure. I think we did. I mean, I grew up, politically during the Reagan years. And, you know, the construct of anyone getting help through the social compact, you know, the welfare queen and the poor small family farmer who lost his farm because of the estate tax. We did focus on social infrastructure, but we were focused on destroying it. It's now when more people actually needed it and realized how insufficient it really is that now I think we have a different viewpoint. And I think it's a good thing.
I agree. I definitely agree. I like your nuance there. And I think the same thing applies to the supply chain, because the supply chain and the loss of domestic manufacturing is something that our union has been talking about since the 80s. But again, this period when we saw that we didn't domestically have the PPE to help our nurses and our doctors, Americans had an aha moment that, holy crap, we've sold our industries to other nations. we make nothing here.
That's it.
So I think this whole period has been an awakening. And I think it's been a rejiggering of the way that we think about these concepts of social infrastructure and supply chains and the need for them. So, you know, I think the pressure that we're still in, because now we all thought that we were emerging from this thing. Now we're in a new phase with Delta. I think that will put additional pressure to make both of these bills actually move through Congress. And so we'll see, you know, they'll be back in the fall. They'll be back in a couple of weeks here in September. We'll see what happens. I think we have a lot of hope that this process will work its way through, and we're going to do everything we can to make sure that it happens.
Yeah, hope, but fight. Last question I've got for you, and I'd be remiss if I didn't ask, will parts of the PRO Act be in this infrastructure? Is it going to remain there? I know they can only do probably some economic parts, but we desperately need people to be able to join and form unions, because I think there's an aha moment here for working people right now that they saw how vulnerable they were. That now maybe this is the time that we see an explosion of organizing and people joining and forming unions, if only we had laws that were helpful.
I think it remains to be seen. You know, I think there certainly is a massive campaign that the AFL-CIO was engaged in. And, you know, to his credit, and God rest his soul, Rich Trumka, I mean, was the champion of the PRO Act and pushing the PRO Act as hard as we possibly can, and through Congress, and ultimately hopefully getting it signed into law. We'll see. I think it remains to be seen how this process unfolds, but I do think it's telling that this administration included it in the American Jobs Plan, which was this administration's infrastructure plan, yeah. That it said that the right to organize is a critical piece of this nation's infrastructure. It meant that family sustaining jobs are a critical piece of this nation's infrastructure. And so, we joined with our brothers and sisters in labor to continue to ask Congress to include it in this package. And I think it remains to be seen what happens.
Yeah, I'm hoping, and I've been pushing as much as I can, because I do see that if we could get some reform, and I don't think we're going to get everything in the PRO Act, but at least something that's going to help a little mm-hmm. bit, that it's going to give us a fighting chance. Sadly, if we don't, I fear if nothing comes of it, this opportunity may pass, and we may be, well, we may be left behind. And that's the thing that's concerning me. As much of a pro-union president as Joe Biden is, and I love that fact about him, if we don't change the laws, it's going to be very difficult for us.
We 1,000% agree with you, Rick.
But again, I hope folks will check the website. Make sure you follow the bus tour, the We Supply America bus tour done by the United Steelworkers. Go to uswvoices.org. We'll get links out on social media on how you can follow along. Roxanne, I appreciate you taking some time for us. Always great stuff you guys do. Get out there and keep spreading the word, and solidarity to your members.
Thank you so much, Rick. Thanks for having me on. Have a great night.
You too. Thanks so much. Again, Roxanne Brown, International Vice President of the U.S. Steelworkers, uswvoices.org, the website. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. The talk.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1927. That was the day that a new radio station began to broadcast on the New York dial. The station's call letters were WEVD. It stood for Eugene V. Debs. The radio station was founded to honor the recently deceased socialist and labor leader. Its goal was to provide a forum to discuss the causes Debs had fought a lifetime for. Progressive labor leaders were involved in the project. The International Lady Garment Workers Union donated space for the studio. Sidney Hillman of the Amalgamated Clothing Workers served on the board. So did A. Philip Randolph of the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters. The station's programming included a show called The Pullman Porter's Hour. It also ran a popular Yiddish language program, The Forward Hour, named after a Yiddish newspaper of the same name. the station provided space for liberal and labor voices that was not available on the commercial radio dial. In 1928, the station had to stave off the Federal Radio Commission to avoid being shut down. The FRC wanted to close down multiple small stations it argued were clogging the airwaves. In 1932, the Forward took over operation of the station. In 2003, the station was bought by ESPN, and its call letters were changed. The radio remains an important forum for the U.S. labor movement. When mainstream media often ignores important labor news, the radio is a place to hear in-depth coverage of issues impacting working people. This includes the friendly voice of Labor History in 2 at the Rick Smith Show. So, the next time you're driving somewhere, spin the dial and see if you can find the voices of labor.
Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and the Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, and follow us on the Twitters at Labor History in 2.